Welcome to the fifth podcast of Year of Wonders. We're going to be covering chapters 9 and 10, and we'll start with among those that go down to the pit and go on to chapter 10, which is the body of the mine. Okay, so we start chapter 9 with Michael outside digging the graves of those people that have died and refuses to stop because basically the sexton, he's the guy that there's the grave digger, died this morning, earlier that morning, John Milston. And basically he'd had a heart attack because of all the work that he'd had to be, that he was doing recently. Eleanor, when Anna says to Eleanor that he can't go on like this, she said, "Believe me, I have seen this for better and for worse." So it kind of echoes a little bit earlier on when she said that his will was stronger than his physical being, but also those words, for better or for worse, also echo the marriage vows too. So again, we're getting that insight into the marital relationship between Eleanor and Michael. When they go round to the Merrill farm and Jacob's dying, you see a really clear contrast between, this is sort of like an early example of a father that actually cares about his children in comparison to Anna's own father. Jacob actually repents of the actions that he committed towards his wife who died, and he also looks to provide materially and emotionally for his children because he knows that he won't be around to do it. There's an ironic kind of comfort from Michael towards Jacob here, though, when he tells Jacob that if we slip and fall, he understands our weakness. And this is really ironic because if you get to the end and Michael kind of recounts what he did to Eleanor and the punishment that he saw fit to kind of mete out to her, instead of leaving it for God, he actually applies it himself. And yet here he's giving comfort to somebody in a completely contradictory sort of way. The thing with Michael here is that he shows how practical he is. He ensures that the people in the village are provided for. He makes sure that Brand, who kind of comes back and doesn't have a family, is actually provided for under the provisions of Jacob Merrill's will, and that the two smaller Merrill children are actually looked after as well by Brand. Anna takes it upon herself in this chapter to ensure that her stepbrothers and sisters are actually looked after. And that Michael is given a rest with the agreement that she strikes with her father. But what she doesn't realise is that she's actually setting in motion this horrible chain of events that will eventually end in Joss's death, although she's not to blame for it. Unlike the Bradfords, the Earl of Chatsworth actually shows himself. We'll get back to the Anna stepbrother and sister type of thing a little bit later on. The Bradfords look after the villagers, and they show themselves very much in a contrast to the Bradfords, who are still absent, basically, and with no hint of coming back. We see the rectory in this chapter becoming a lot like the Gowdy cottage. Eleanor and Anna are trying remedies that will help provide comfort. I don't know if they're necessarily looking for a cure, but they're looking for something that might kind of work or might stave off the plague developing. And they inadvertently, as Anna says, they inadvertently kind of discover certain things that would ease the common ailments and injuries, as she says. And then somehow we found ourselves sought out for the kinds of preparations that Gowdy's once so readily supplied. So they're kind of taking the place of the Gowdy's in the village. And I suppose you could say in some respects that they are looking for a cure, although they're looking to maybe slow it down as opposed to kind of stopping it altogether. But it's interesting that they're convinced that there's some sort of answer that lies in the natural world of the herbal preparations that they're now sort of finding themselves developing. That Sunday, Michael seeks to reassure the congregation in a sermon that things may get worse before they get better, but he actually faints, which doesn't provide the greatest amount of comfort, you could say, to the villagers that are left. And he reassures them that regardless of where somebody is buried, it doesn't mean to say that they won't go to heaven. The whole idea of being buried in consecrated ground means that you've sort of assured heavenly passage. And because there are so many people dying, actually getting them to the churchyard and finding enough ground for them is starting to prove something of a problem. Michael actually faints up at the pulpit. And it's interesting here because Stanley steps in. Now, Stanley, remember, is the old Puritan minister who used to be sort of minister of that parish before restoration. And so what he does is he steps in, rallies the congregation, brings them together, and he's very, instead of the sort of the touchy-feely humanist kind of approach that Michael uses, Stanley's very much the pull yourselves together, this is what we've got to do, start behaving like a group with a common purpose. And you can see Michael's personal kind of spiritual crisis developing very much in this chapter when he says, why dost thou hide thy face from me? So it's actually a psalm, but it's also a very good insight into this spiritual crisis that Michael's going through. When they say that, when he sort of, Stanley says, the cuckle at Delph. Now that's kind of like an outdoor area, and what it's doing is it's replacing the church. So they're now afraid of actually spreading the plague in an enclosed space. So they figure that if they go to an outside place, then they'll be safer. They'll have less chance of passing on the plague seeds, as it were. Mary Wickford makes an appearance in this. And we get quite a lot of backstory about the Wickfords, about them as a Quaker couple. Again, if you're not sure about who the Quakers were, I'd suggest that you do a quick kind of Google on the Quaker religion. And although Anna kind of gives us some indication about their religious practices here, it's also useful to know just in a little bit more detail about why it's important that they were very much a family that kept to themselves, and why the Wickford mine is something that people actually want. Both Eleanor and Anna try to do what Michael would actually stop them doing. So they've become a lot more independent of their, of him, and also within their social roles at the time. Now, given that they were women, and women were kind of, you know, had very clear kind of defined roles, it's interesting that they're really stepping outside and kind of challenging those social roles and responsibilities here. And so what they do is, through their understanding and empathy of Mary Wickford's situation, this child who's been left without a family, and a mine that other miners are starting to nick. Now, remember, she actually does go through and explain what the process is of taking over somebody else's mine. You have to nick it within a certain period of time. And if you don't do anything to defend your mine, then the person that does the nicking actually has the right to mine it. They go down. They need like a quantity of lead. They need the quantity of lead because they've got a 9-week period in which to produce this dish of lead before Mary's kind of turned out and has no loyalty, has no family kind of to go to. So they go beneath the rock. They try and chip away and find that it's actually pretty useless. So they decide to blow up part of the mine in order to loosen enough lead to put onto the dish. And the lovely thing about this is that they do it together. Anna takes charge. She's very much in this, I think, somebody that's confident in taking the lead. And the tables have kind of turned in the relationship, whereas Eleanor has been in the lead initially, then they've kind of become equals. And in this, Anna's like, no, you need to go to the surface. She's got pretty much, Eleanor's got more to live for, essentially. Anna's kind of like, okay, there's that calm acceptance that she finds herself experiencing underneath in the mine. And this is kind of shown on page 185 when she said, "And then an odd thing, the panic drained away from me and my mind filled up with images of my boys. It had become hard for me to call up the exact details of their faces, the fall of Jamie's curls across his brow, or Tom's sweet, serious frown at feedings. Now they were before me, vivid as in life. I stopped fighting for movement and exhaled the breath I had been hoarding. There was no air now to give me another. I relaxed my cheek into the rocks that would be my cairn and my tombstone. Now, cairn is essentially a pile of rocks, and it's used as a grave marker. You'll find that a lot of, if you, in the United Kingdom, there are various points at which cairns are actually erected to, as sort of tombstones or above ground kind of burial points for people. They take the dish. They manage to get enough lead, and they take the dish to the miners in the tap room. And it says here, Alan Horton, who was kind of the leader in this particular scene at the tap room at the inn on page 188, says, "Friends," said Alan Horton, "young Mary Wickford retains the rights over burning Drake Vane. It's hers until such time as her stoves be thrice nicked." And then he stared around the room from under his impressive bushy eyebrows. "And I'm saying naught about his right to do it. I'd be a man thinking long and hard about cutting any nicks in this child's stoves any time in the near future, within our code though it may well be." So he's kind of giving the rest of the miners fair warning, and in doing so, respecting Eleanor and Anna's efforts in maintaining and protecting Mary Wickford's claim on this mine. Anna's sleep that night is interesting because it's the sleep of someone that's actually done something that she's proud of. It's the sleep of perhaps redemption and satisfaction of doing something that actually has a really tangible, concrete outcome. And there's a pleasure in her knowing that, which is kind of another turning point for her. Okay, so that's the end of chapter 9. A bit of a break, and we'll go into the body of the mine, which is chapter 10. Okay, so chapter 10, the body of the mine. Now, this is the chapter in which we really get to see the full extent of Joss and his cruel, ruthless side. Anna's starting to feel the effects of it, and by association, people in the village are starting to treat her really differently. We see him on the first page of that chapter on 189. She says he was staggering, which was not unusual, but not this day from drink. As he advanced, I saw that it was the weight of what he carried that unbalanced him, a large sack that clanked as he walked. Basically, people are now paying him to dig their graves, and he's exploiting them for that. And earlier on in one of the earlier podcasts, I mentioned something along the lines of, it was a situation, the plague, in which it brought out the best in human nature and also brought out the worst in human nature too. So the closing of the church and the outdoor sermons in Cucklet Delph, where people are standing 3 feet apart from each other, demonstrates the physical distance that people are now starting to show with each other, but also how the fear is actually set in and people are starting to kind of get divided in terms of their loyalties, and they're not so much a cohesive community anymore, which makes what Joss is doing a prime situation to exploit for his own ends. There's no one there to keep an eye on him because Michael's rushing around the village trying to provide comfort, write up wills, basically say final prayers for the people that are dying. And so Joss is unchecked. There's no one there that's kind of calling him to account for his just callous behavior and refuses to listen to reason. So Anna is basically saying, okay, enough. She's calling it, that's enough. I'm not actually going to have anything to do with him. And this is kind of painful because she realizes that it will actually have an effect on the relationship that she has with her stepbrothers and sisters and also with Afra, but it's just enough. She does actually try and call him on it too. She says, "You know that a bale is a thieving price to charge Mrs. Martin for the hour's toil of burying her husband. How can you choose the suffering so? You bring disgrace on us by such conduct." He made me no reply, just hawked and spat a glistening gob of green phlegm at my feet and continued on his way to the tavern. So when she was earlier on in the book, she was afraid to kind of challenge him and sort of call into question his authority. Now she's actually not afraid to do so, but he doesn't care at all. And then when Michael does eventually get out there with Anna and say, okay, I can understand that you're actually doing this. I can understand why you're doing it. And that, okay, it's an unnatural situation, but payment is sort of to be expected. Be proportionate. And he's like, be proportionate. You bleed us dry. You do. Your kind, all of you, think nothing of breaking our backs for a pittance. And then he's basically, Joss Bont won't be foxed by the likes of you. Bury the poxy dead yourself if you feel so strong. It's a blatant rejection of Michael, his authority, and any kind of spiritual hold that he has over Joss. The Unwin situation is actually the final straw. So this is what brings Joss to his final end, and possibly deservedly so. Christopher Unwin is unwell, and he's not dead. He's really unwell, but he's not dead yet. But Joss is actually outside digging his grave. And Michael's like, basically, what are you doing? And he says, I'm digging the grave and I expect payment. So you had better find out where I'm going to get this money from, basically, because I will actually be paid. Now, Michael actually goes out and physically confronts him, but Joss goes to hit Michael and Michael steps out of the way and Joss ends up humiliated and falling into the grave himself, which is ironic and quite a delicious outcome, actually. Because he's been humiliated to this degree, he gets himself absolutely totaled. He attacks Christopher as punishment for the humiliation the men in the tavern have thrown him out, and then he goes back to Christopher's house and tries to bury him alive. Now, Christopher's actually a miner, so even though he's been pushed into the grave and covered with dirt, and keep in mind, this man is really unwell, he manages to keep himself alive by creating an air pocket around his face. He says here, on page 199, and then when I woke again, I was in my grave. That spawn of Satan had laid me there, though I was yet quick as you are. Lucky for me, in his laziness and lust to be in my possessions, he scattered just a crust of earth to hide me and not enough to smother me entire. So not only did he push Christopher into the grave, cover him with dirt, and take his possessions inside the cottage, he actually stole the clothes that Christopher was lying in as well. I mean, that's the depths of the depravity that Joss has actually sunk to. The men in the tavern go after Joss, and Anna actually does nothing to stop them. I stood there until the mob turned up the hill and out of my sight, and then I went inside and prepared for the labours of my day. So she's made her position very clear. And even when they gather at the courtyard of the tavern and the miners call, it's sort of like a judicial kind of group that they form, they ask if there's anyone actually going to speak for him, and nobody says anything. She doesn't say anything. On page 203, Josiah Bont, since you do own these crimes, we do find thee guilty. Does anyone wish to speak for this man before I proclaim his penalty? Every eye in the place turned to me then, where I stood by the wall to the right of Alan Horton, trying to vanish into the shadows. Every eye, including my father's. His glare was hard at first, the prideful look of a cock of the walk. But as I gazed back at him in silence, the look changed to one of surprise and then confusion, and finally, as the realization that I would not speak came at last upon him, his whole face sagged. There was rage there, but also disappointment and the slow dawning of a sad understanding. I had to look away then, for that hint of his grief was more than I could bear. Oh, I knew I would pay for my silence, but I could not speak for him, or rather, would not. So she's figuring that payment for this humiliation is deferred. She will get punishment from him in whatever form, but at this point she actually can't bring herself to say anything. His punishment was actually to have a knife put through his hands. So it's punishment for greedy hands. And your hands, Alan Horton says, have been uncommonly greedy. And so the court does hereby impose upon you the age-old remedy. Thou shalt be taken from here to the Unwin mine, so Christopher Unwin, where he actually, you know, tried to steal all his possessions, and impaled to its stows by a knife through the hands. Which is, if you can imagine, just the sheer thought of, you can't move. Your hands are stuck with a knife. You can't obviously kind of pull anything out. It's a horrific crime, but it's a crime to match. It's a punishment to match the crime. Now, Anna figures that Aphra is going to come for him. But Aphra didn't come because 3 out of 4 of her children got the plague that same day. And her youngest girl, Faith, was the only one not stricken. So she's at home. She's looking after the 3 out of the 4 children that have the plague. Aphra's figuring that Anna's going to go and release them. Anna's figuring that Aphra's going to go and release them. And neither of them do it. And it turns out that he actually dies up there. Aphra comes to see Anna. So on page 206, she says, "Tell me he is here, Anna," she said. And at first I had no idea what she was speaking about. And then the realization for both of them that the other one didn't go up and release him. Anna follows her up there, and she actually tries to get him off, get the dagger out of his hands. "She walked straight up to the stones and tugged at the dagger that held what was left of my father. It was driven hard into the wood and did not budge when she laid her bandaged hands upon it. Only when she planted a boot on the upright and threw her whole body's weight against it did the knife finally slide free, grating against bone. She looked at it for a long moment and then began to wield it on my father's hair, shearing off large locks and plunging them in her pocket. Then she tore off a piece of my father's jerkin to wrap the blade and tuck the dagger into her girdle." So not only has she lost her husband, this is Aphra, but the 3 children that contracted the plague actually died as well. So she's left with her daughter Faith. And this is the point at which Aphra starts to lose her sanity, which will have terrible implications later on, as you know. And that insanity that Aphra's starting to display kind of becomes a little bit clearer at the end of the chapter when Anna starts saying the Lord's Prayer. "And I thought she was saying it with me in a low, deep-throated murmur. But when I said amen, her muttering continued, and the sign she made at the end of it did not resemble the sign of the cross." And so I think you could probably say that with now pretty much everyone in the village being personally affected by the plague and the associated crimes, things are really starting to unravel and becoming a lot more personal for everybody, including the Montpellians, who will later kind of suffer firsthand. They've pretty much escaped it up until this point. All right, so that ends this particular podcast. Next podcast will cover the final chapters, and then we'll get on to the themes and the characters. Okay, I'll catch you next time.